become the ideal and the perfect human being. In one instance, Imam al-Baqir talks to his companion and he says that Allah gives the world to those whom He loves and those whom He detests. However, Allah gives religion, faith, deen to those whom Allah loves only. Dear friends, it's so interesting here. Sometimes we see that the good guys, they seem to have a lot of things when it comes to the world. So when here Imam al-Baqir says that Allah gives the world, he's talking about what on the superficial level seems to be the materialistic world. So Allah gives the materialistic world to the people He loves and to the people He detests, to the people He hates, to the bad guys. So He gives the material world to the bad guys as well, and He gives the material world to the good guys as well. So what's the differentiating factor? What makes a good guy different from the bad guy? What is it that the person who follows the religion of Islam or the person who follows the God-given religions of righteousness, if a human being follows the good word of Allah, what is different from them and, you know, people who reject faith, the people who reject good deeds, the people who reject righteousness and honor and nobility? Well, Imam al-Baqir tells us that Allah gives faith, He gives religion, He gives righteousness, He gives nobility, He gives honor, He gives deen. Deen is religion, to those people who He loves. And He does not give religion, He does not give deen to those people who He detests. And dear friends, when it came down to the materialistic world or the religion, deen, Islam, guidance, salvation, which of these two will we choose? I don't know about you, but I would choose religion. I would choose salvation. I would choose guidance. You know why? Because religion, Islam, is what will save you in the hereafter. And it is the hereafter which will last forever. The materialistic world, sure, we might be able to enjoy it for, what, 40, 50, 60, 70, 80, 100 years of this lifetime. But afterwards, we won't be able to enjoy a single penny. So, if you have religion, thank Allah for it. And if you don't have religion, it is time for you to get some religion. Beautiful words from Imam al-Baqir, alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
La ilaha illallah. La ilaha illallah.
And now we invite you to listen to Sheikh Hamza Sodagar.
What I'd like to discuss in our remembrance of Imam al-Baqir salamullahi alayhi briefly is a matter that I think applies to us today. Imam al-Baqir has been given that title, otherwise his name is Muhammad ibn Ali salamullahi alayhima. His name is Muhammad. His nickname, his laqab, as it is referred to, or the word used in Arabic, which means that this is a name given to him. The meaning of the word is someone who splits, the one who splits the seed of the knowledge after the Prophet, or the seed of the knowledge of prophets. The reason why Imam al-Baqir is known for that is the knowledge of the Holy Prophet, for various reasons, for now close to a century, has been kept from the people. The people were told at one point that in order to make sure the Quran is preserved, we must burn all the writings of the sayings of the Prophet. And anyone who kept any writing of the sayings of the Prophet was forced to burn it, or get rid of it, or destroy it one way or another. The narration of hadith was restricted to certain individuals who did not pass on the knowledge of the Prophet, the sunnah of the Prophet as it was. Fabrications began to emerge. Those who knew the knowledge of the Ahlul Bayt, Ali ibn Abi Talib, salamullah alayhi, was put in a position not to be speaking publicly and to share that knowledge. Imam al-Mujtaba similarly, Imam al-Husayn similarly. In different ways, the conditions that they were in, there wasn't much that could be said. The Imams did share their knowledge in different ways, of course, that when we discuss those Imams and their struggle and their plans and how they conducted themselves as the Imams of the Ummah during their time. And Imam Zain al-Abidin was in a very critical time as well. But the reason why Imam al-Baqir is given that title is because on a more public scale, the Imam is now sharing the knowledge of the Prophet and the Prophets on a more public scale.
Thank you very much, dear friends, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
Around the world with reporters.
The International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA's Board of Governors, convenes a week-long meeting to discuss monitoring and verification in Iran, among other issues. Director General Rafael Mariano Grossi expressed concern over a lack of progress in discussions about the presence of nuclear material in four undeclared locations in Iran.
The Iranian government has reiterated its will to engage and to cooperate and to provide answers, but they haven't done that so far. So I hope this may change. But as we speak, we haven't had any concrete progress on any of the issues.
Iranian ambassador to the IAEA, Kazem Gharibabadi, says he's asked the agency not to use some unimportant issues dating to around two decades ago as an excuse to politicize Iran's case at a time when negotiations are underway to revive the nuclear deal between Iran and world powers, known as the JCPOA. Grossi acknowledged there's nothing that indicates there is a danger when it comes to the safeguards-related issues, but stressed that the agency would not stop asking questions. In his latest report, Grossi also said the agency's access to Iranian nuclear facilities has been restricted since the 23rd of February as a result of a parliamentary law that obliges the government to go ahead with enrichment and other nuclear activities, and to deny the agency broader or complementary access beyond the country's regular safeguards obligations. Under a temporary agreement between Tehran and the agency, valid until the 24th of June, the IAEA will continue to collect data at Iran's key nuclear facilities via its surveillance equipment, but will not be able to access that data. Grossi said an extension of that agreement was becoming increasingly difficult. Iran says it will transfer all the collected data to the agency and return to full compliance with the JCPOA after the verifiable removal of all U.S. sanctions. Homolizki, Vienna.
With more than a week left to the upcoming presidential election in Iran, the rivalry gets tighter. After a showdown between the candidates in the first debate, now they continue their campaigns on social media and national television. As the raucous debate revealed little information about the candidates' future plans, reporters try to extract more details through briefing sessions.
If we want to take strides in job creation, we need to pull the plug on sales of raw material. On top of them is crude oil. If one oil barrel gets us $50, its petrochemical products get us an added value of up to $2,000.
The upstream and downstream oil sectors have the potential to generate 880,000 jobs, but unfortunately, 25% of the petrochemical sector is not tapped into. If we operate this unused part, we can save $5 billion in petrochemical imports, and at the same time, we would generate thousands of jobs.
During his two terms as Iran's president, Hassan Rouhani did a lot with regards to foreign policy, clinching the 2015 nuclear deal with world powers, while retaining the country's intimate ties with its eastern partners, namely China and Russia. Now, as the Atomic Accord is facing a bumpy road ahead, most of the candidates believe it's not the master key for fixing Iran's economy.
The removal of sanctions isn't tied to negotiations with the U.S. We can instead neutralize the effect of the sanctions by tapping into myriad of resources in our country, such as rich mineral reserves.
This year, the coronavirus pandemic has curtailed election rallies and electoral tours. Campaigns are conducted through televised debates between candidates, feature documentaries, and speeches. The second and third debates are scheduled for Tuesday and Saturday, respectively, which will be themed with cultural and political issues. Campaigning will continue until 24 hours before Election Day, on June 18th.
Well, the first debate was more pugnacious and less informative. It did not give a clear image of each of the candidates' policies. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
After the failure of Moscow talks, an Omani delegation along with the Yemeni negotiating delegation has arrived at Sana'a Airport as part of efforts to find a peaceful solution to the years-long war on Yemen. Mohammed Abdus Salam, who headed the Yemeni delegation at the talks, said the meeting was aimed at pushing out the humanitarian situation that has been deteriorating due to the all-out blockade imposed by Saudi Arabia.
The talks are held to discuss the overall situation in Yemen, including the peace talks and the humanitarian crisis in Yemen. Oman has always served as an arena for all Yemenis in political affairs, and today we are going to complete the efforts we made in Oman during the past months.
Observers say this move could make a difference in the political process, as Oman has always been beside Yemenis and realizes the circumstances of Yemen.
The Omani delegation is welcomed in our country because Oman has always been a good neighbor. We hope Oman could help us remove the current humanitarian crisis. We must have this point in mind that if the U.S. continues to link the humanitarian crisis in Yemen to the military realities on the ground, no progress would be made. Therefore, the humanitarian crisis in Yemen should be top on agenda.
The latest round of negotiations in Oman's capital, Muscat, failed to find a solution to the world's worst humanitarian crisis in Yemen. According to the UN Office for Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, the Saudi-led coalition war on Yemen has killed almost a quarter of a million Yemenis, caused outbreaks of disease, turned Yemen into the world's worst humanitarian crisis, and brought the poor Arab country to the verge of famine.
Yemenis are optimistic about the Omani delegation visit to their country, saying Oman is capable of achieving what the UN envoy has failed during the past years and putting an end to the suffering of the war-ravaged nation. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
As India continues to battle the deadly COVID-19 pandemic, the destitute Rohingya community fights it all alone. The community is not eligible to apply for vaccine since they are described as illegal immigrants. Rights activists say they are in desperate need of help as the virus has started raging across the camps.
First they started the deportation drive, then detention, and now the lockdowns. Why are all miseries for us? Why is the world silent? Don't we have the right to live? We have no work due to lockdowns, and now this virus is frightening us, since we can't get access to any healthcare services here.
The COVID-19 pandemic has brought more miseries to the community, since most of them used to work in the unorganized sector. Now, due to lockdowns, most of them have lost their jobs, forcing them to live on charity, while hunger and poverty looms over the community. The refugee camps are cramped, and the spread of virus is inevitable, they say, since their makeshift shanties lean on each other with no sanitation, food support, or health care, since they are not included in the government's support programs. Most of them work as daily wage workers or scrap collectors to make a living, but the government restrictions and lockdown has left many out of work. Some locals and NGOs are helping us with food and other essentials in these dire times. We, however, urge the UN Refugee Agency to play their part. We don't need just guidelines. We need access to vaccination. Minority Rohingya Muslims have for decades fled to neighboring Bangladesh and other countries, including India, escaping genocide in their country. Estimates suggest some 40,000 Rohingya refugees are living across different Indian states.
In recent weeks, many of these refugees, including children, had developed COVID-like symptoms. But due to lack of testing facilities and shortage of vaccine, they're on their own. Most of them have resorted to home remedies and self-quarantine. Many, however, fear if they don't get access to medicine and vaccine, a humanitarian disaster awaits their community. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
Yemen Nasrallah movement dismissed as baseless an accusation by the U.S., which mentioned the movement as the main cause behind the war in Yemen. Earlier, the U.S. State Department issued a statement accusing the Nasrallah movement of prolonging the conflict and worsening Yemen's humanitarian crisis by attacking Marib, the last stronghold of the Saudi-backed forces in northern Yemen.
The accusation of the U.S. State Department against the Ansarullah movement is part of a larger plan to stop Yemen's army advancement towards the city of Marib. Yemenis will not give in to these pressures. The mediator must be neutral, but the U.S. is biased towards the Saudi-led coalition.
Yemen said the USB's major responsibility for the ongoing humanitarian crisis in Yemen as it supports the Saudi blockade on the war-torn country. They called on the international community to prosecute the U.S. for committing war crimes against the women and the children of Yemen.
The U.S. State Department is not in a position to accuse the Ansarullah movement because the war in Yemen has been led by the U.S. Therefore, the U.S. is involved in the war and cannot serve as a mediator. We call on the international community to put the U.S. on trial over committing war crimes against Yemeni children and women.
Earlier, the head of the Yemeni negotiating delegation participating in peace talks in Oman said the other parties are haggling over the suffering of millions of Yemenis for military gains, adding that it is the right of all Yemenis to obtain food, medicine and fuel, even under the ongoing war.
Yemenis say the U.S. has no right to blame them as it is one of the parties of the current war on their country. They believe that bargaining over their suffering is a clear violation of the international law. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
A number of associations of Palestinians from across Italy jointly organized a demonstration in solidarity with the people of Palestine. A large crowd flooded in Rome's iconic San Giovanni Square to hold a rally dubbed Stop the Occupation, Free Palestine, Jerusalem or Quds is our capital. Protesters held banners and placards reading Stop the War and Sanctions on Israel.
Politicians, trade union members, anti-war campaigners, people from all walks of life have joined the demonstration demanding justice for Palestinians. They are calling on the Italian government to take a firm stance on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
I think it is a matter of political opportunism. That's why Italy's support to Palestine has been shifting towards positions inconsistent with those held in the past. There is also a lack of commitment on the part of the moderate political forces that used to hold a balanced stance on the conflict. The rise of right-wing parties and their alignment with Netanyahu's government has changed the dynamics entirely.
Unfortunately, we know full well how economic interests play a crucial role in foreign policy. But we have some good news finally, as on June 2nd, the European Trade Union Confederation issued a resolution calling on Israel to withdraw from the occupied territories. Also, working movements are shifting towards pro-Palestinian positions.
Protesters also called on EU member states to impose sanctions on Israel to put an end to what they called a flagrant violation of international law taking place in Palestine. Tens of demonstrations in solidarity with Palestine have been held across Italy in recent days. About 2 weeks ago, pro-Palestine groups staged protests at the Rai national broadcaster headquarters and branches in several Italian cities, complaining that the persecution of Palestinians has been sugar-coated in Israel's favor by the public television company. Max Civili, Rome.
Hundreds of British pro-Palestine activists amassed outside a notorious arms manufacturer near Blackburn on Friday, demanding an end to Israeli arms sales. Anger was vented in various ways, including with a funeral procession honoring the recent martyrdom of over 60 children slain in Gaza.
It's a genocide that's occurring before our eyes. Companies like BAE Systems are complicit in what's going on there. They're providing illegal weaponry.
Now they've been exposed, the Zionist regime, because from footage from underground, from Gaza, has come out. And people are starting to realize that this is an apartheid, ethnic cleansing, colonialism regime that is operating, and it has to end.
Today, we came here to send a message to the world. What is the mistake of these children? 64 children have been killed innocent. Some of them were sleeping in the hands of their parents, and they found themselves dead. Why? One, the answer is occupation. In the occupation, everything will be sorted out.
BAE Systems is one of Britain's biggest arms dealers and is known for building weapons used by Middle Eastern regimes to target innocent civilians in conflict zones.
Essentially here to register our protest and say to BAE Systems and to the government that this is simply unacceptable, that weapons manufactured here in Lancashire, here in England, should be used against civilians in Gaza and in Palestine.
This is the second week that local residents have come in good numbers to condemn BAE Systems, and more action is being planned.
May
Major arms firms such as this have been heavily criticized many times in the past. However, it's very rare for protest movements of this size and frequency to engage in such regular and very direct action. Now, these locals are coming out in numbers, hoping to force a change which will inevitably save lives in places like Palestine and elsewhere too. Robert Carter, Blackburn.
With only less than 2 weeks to go before Iran's presidential elections, the seven candidates have expressed their views and plans in conferences, TV programs, and interviews. Some have criticized the current economic policies, while others pledged to make some fundamental reforms if elected. Mohsen Mehralizadeh said he would seek de-escalation between Iran and other countries, noting that the government should not let for some factors to detach the country from the rest of the world. He also pledged to form a cabinet made of experienced people who are able to solve people's problems. Ebrahim Raisi pledged to do his utmost to end the corruption in the country. He also pointed out the issue of unemployment as a major problem young Iranians are struggling with. He vowed to help the youth with their employment and housing problems. Raisi stressed that his first priority would be people's livelihoods and welfare. Alireza Zakani, who is currently serving as a parliament member, said he would seek a comprehensive progress of the country. He also criticized Iran's current foreign policy and stressed that the country's foreign policy should serve the economy, culture, society, politics, and security by taking a broader horizon into consideration. Former central bank governor Abdel Nasser Himmati said he is a reformist and his main agenda is economic reforms. He called on Iranians to support him with their votes. Himmati noted the mass COVID-19 vaccination would be his first plan after winning the race. Another candidate, Amir Hossein Qazizadeh Hashemi, said his main goal is to support the people by reducing household expenses and increasing purchasing power. He also pledged to eliminate economic rent-seeking and lessen the government's interference in the process of production, imports, and distribution of goods. Former top nuclear negotiator Saeed Jalili called for a strategy in which people can observe and monitor the performance of the government. However, he called on Iranian people not to wait for anyone and continue their efforts towards the development of the country, regardless of who is going to win the presidential race. Mohsen Rezaei criticized former and current administrations for adopting wrong economic policies. Rezaei said such measures have caused economic hardships Iranians have been dealing with for years. The 66-year-old hopeful also called for unity among Iranians in order to be able to overcome the economic crisis.
Squalid accommodation that was not fit to house human beings fleeing persecution. That was how lawyers representing six asylum seekers described Napier Military Barracks in Kent in a case brought to the British High Court. In a landmark ruling, Mr. Justice Lyndon agreed and said all of them were
vulnerable victims of trafficking and or torture who experienced a deterioration in their mental health as a result of their accommodation at Napier Barracks.
Napier Barracks has turned into a resident site for vulnerable asylum seekers despite a warning from Public Health England that the dormitories were not suitable accommodation during a pandemic. However, the court found that this advice was not followed, leading to a COVID outbreak infecting half the residents.
The Home Office responded to the ruling with this statement.
Throughout this period, our accommodation providers and subcontractors have made improvements to the site and continue to do so. It is disappointing that this judgment was reached on the basis of the site prior to the significant improvement works which have taken place in difficult circumstances. Napier will continue to operate and provide safe and secure accommodation. We will carefully consider the ruling and our next steps.
Human rights campaigner Adam Yassir came to the UK as a refugee from Darfur in Sudan. He's been supporting asylum seekers who've been staying at Napier Barracks and gave a witness testimony to the High Court.
Multiple asylum seekers asked me to provide a noise cancellation earplugs, and I asked, and they say the guys say to me some people scream at night, they've got PTSD.
Calls are mounting for the Home Office to shut down the controversial barracks after a damning court ruling found that they had acted unlawfully and irrationally, which could potentially lead to damages against the British Home Secretary Priti Patel.
They felt they need to, they've been used used to send message to other asylum seekers, people who are trying to seek safety and security in the UK. But it is the wrong way. It is breaking the law to make a point. It's not the right way, and it isn't working at all. It isn't working. Hence, someone needs to be accountable, and the Home Secretary should actually consider her position.
The ruling by the High Court would be a vindication for lawyers, rights groups and activists alike, who for too long have had their concerns regarding Napier Barracks ignored. But they will still feel their fight is far from over, while asylum seekers still remain housed there in what the court described as appalling conditions. Ahmed Cabello, London.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
There is clearly a global pattern that connects UNHCR involvement to unrest in refugee camps. The question is, why has this pattern been ignored for more than a decade? In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Gionette Bernier, writer. This article is published under the heading, Refugees Insist Humanitarian Organization UNHCR Disregards Their Humanity. Stay tuned for more. Since late 2019, waves of protest against the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, UNHCR, the supranational branch of United Nations that works to help displaced populations globally, have rocked a refugee camp in Lebanon that holds over 2,000 Sudanese and Ethiopian inhabitants. For months, refugee protesters have stood behind the gates of the camp in front of flimsy, poorly insulated tents and held sit-ins in front of a UNHCR building. Their signs read, "Where are my rights?" And they proclaim the UNHCR does not respect their humanity. In December 2019, these protests became so disruptive, at one point even devolving into riots, that the UNHCR called its own staff and security forces to arrest and detain many of the protesters. One of the organizers of the protest, a 30-year-old Sudanese refugee named Abdul Baghi, acknowledged that many of the refugee protesters were frustrated by systematic issues with the UNHCR, such as inadequate provision of basic services and a convoluted resettlement process. However, he noted that those grievances are not the primary motivation behind the protest.
Instead, these refugees resent that there are abuses that have happened on the part of the UNHCR, a general sense of neglect and disrespect for the refugees as human beings, with no training of their staff, on top of them saying that they have no funds. Specifically, many protesters are claiming they had been verbally threatened or harassed by the UNHCR staff. Unrest has long been a defining feature of refugee camps. Overcrowding, tensions between displaced groups of different national origins, and a lack of resources, issues that are understandably endemic to the resettlement and asylum process given the scale of the global refugee crisis, are oft-cited explanations for camp protests. However, refugees feeling as though the UNHCR has not treated them as human beings, worthy of equal dignity, may be an overlooked catalyst of this unrest. It is helpful to think of this issue through historian and director of the World Peace Foundation, Alex D. Wolf's framework of inescapable and escapable cruelties. On one hand, inescapable cruelty for humanitarian organizations comes in the contrast between the overwhelming global need and organizations' resource constraints. The cruelty of choosing between equally vulnerable people and populations, especially for limited resettlement opportunities, is inherent to and inescapable from humanitarian work. Escapable cruelty, on the other hand, refers to failing of humanitarian organizations that are entirely avoidable. The UNHCR's explanation for the unrest in Lebanon uses the typical excuse of inescapable cruelties for violence in refugee camps to dodge the issue of potential dehumanization and inescapable cruelty. In response to the protesters, the UNHCR head of field in Beirut, Laura Almiral, made this statement: "We consider everyone, but it doesn't mean that everyone can or will get the services, from cash assistance, healthcare, to access to education. We are working with limited funding and resources." While this response might explain the neglect of which these refugees have accused the UNHCR, it does not explain the allegations that the UNHCR, a humanitarian organization, has unnecessarily disrespected these refugees' humanity. The Lebanon protests suggest that there are two different conversations occurring around human rights in refugee camps. The UNHCR's narrative has emerged in Almiral's response in a statement on the institution's official Facebook page, where it characterized the allegations of disrespect as inaccurate and misleading, stating that UNHCR staff have at no time used verbal or physical abuse against the protesters, leaving the protesters largely ignored. Is there any truth to the UNHCR's denial? It would seem that history is not on the side. In a 2010 survey of various African origin refugees living in Egyptian camps, nearly a quarter of respondents reported that their interactions with the staff from UNHCR, Cairo, were their worst life experiences since the war-related atrocities they fled. Furthermore, 90.9% of respondents felt quite a bit or extremely betrayed by the UNHCR after its official called Egyptian security forces to disperse informal refugee settlements in Egypt, with no attempts made to engage in conversation or negotiate with the refugees. The confrontation between the refugees and security forces resulted in 23 deaths, hundreds of arrests, and thousands of injuries. All study participants reported feelings of frequent hate, resentment, and disgust towards the UNHCR as a result of the betrayal. The Egyptian case represented overt dismissals of refugee concerns, but the UNHCR's dehumanization of refugees can also be more subtle and systematic. Take, for example, a group of Burundian refugees' attempt to violently take public authority in a Tanzanian refugee camp away from the UNHCR camp officials and establish self-governance. There is clearly a global pattern that connects UNHCR involvement to unrest in refugee camps. The question is, why has this pattern been ignored for more than a decade? With few or no media outlets available to them, refugees' grievances have been drowned out by the UNHCR perpetuated narrative, especially when that narrative is amplified and endorsed by the international press. Events like protracted riots in Moura refugee camp on the island of Lesbos, Greece, have driven mainstream media reporting on this trend of refugee resentment towards the UNHCR. However, major news outlets such as CNN and Al Jazeera have chalked up the asylum seekers' grievances to systematic problems such as overcrowding, lack of appropriate settlers, and insufficient food. Some sources have been attributed the most recent unrest in Moura as misplaced anger stemming from their frustration that the pandemic has brought resettlement to standstill. In doing so, these sources have perpetuated the UNHCR's narrative that any cruelties they have committed are inescapable. Millions of asylum seekers around the world live in similarly poor conditions in camps and informal settlements. But not all camps are plagued by riots, and not all camps' dwellers express virulent anger towards the camp governors in the way the refugees in Lebanon, Egypt, and Tanzania have towards the UNHCR. Clearly, the refugees in case studies mentioned were not mobilized by poor quality of life, but because people who represent the UNHCR have added unnecessary insult to their inevitable injury. Despite the UNHCR's attempts to downplay or discredit these complaints, where there is smoke, there is fire. Feeling dehumanized by the UNHCR is a complaint that spans across different nationalities, countries, and continents. In fact, this feeling has even united refugees of different ethnic groups and national origins, identifiers that usually divide camp dwellers.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you.
From Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Lovely listeners, thank you so very much for joining us on today's episode of Muslim Lady. We're proud to bring you this show only on IRB English Radio. And of course, in the studio, as always, I have my special guest and darling sister, Sister Razia Shamini. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Dear Zainab, happy to be here.
I'm totally excited to have you with us again so we can continue our active discussion. So we've been talking on these last few episodes about the importance of spousal selection, obviously, and how it should be done at a very sooner time than we thought.
because not only does it affect our life and the life of our families and the life of that guy or that girl and the life of their family, but the future generation and the society and the ecosystem and most probably the universe.
Here we're going to talk about shared spiritual points that both spouses should consider. So there is a beautiful hadith from Imam Ali alayhi salam that says, فَاسْتَشْفُوهُ مِنْ أَدْوَائِكُمْ. Use Quran to cure your illnesses. That's a very, very deep claim.
It really is.
For your فَاسْتَشْفُوهُ for مِنْ أَدْوَائِكُمْ, right? This especially could be feasible or practical for a Muslim lady. These could be physical. وَنُنَزِّلُ مِنَ الْقُرْآنَ مَا هُوَ الشِّفَاءٌ وَرَحْمَةٌ وَلَا يَزِيدُ الظَّالِمِينَ إِلَّا خَسَارًا, right?
What does that mean?
That we have sent the Qur'an as a remedy, as a shifa.
As a cure.
It's a cure for mu'mineen, right? And to the transgressors, it will only add them more pain, more problems, more challenges in life. So there we go. This is about, and there are certain surahs of the Quran that are to be recited preconception phase. Mm-hmm. Four famous ones are we say the four qul, right? Qul huwa Allahu ahad, qul a'udhu bi rabbin nas, qul a'udhu bi rabbin falaq, and qul ya ayyuhal kafirun, right? If you really want to know why these four, go to the meaning of it. I just wrote one of the meanings just to recite it for the believers so they would understand the depth of the meaning and how it can spiritually impact them. It says, قُلْ أَعُوذُ بِرَبِّ
Impact the mommy who is carrying a
baby.
The baby, right.
The Muslim lady. أَعُوذُ بِاللَّهِ مِنَ الشَّيْطَانِ الرَّجِيمِ بِسْمِ اللَّهِ الرَّحْمَنِ الرَّحِيمِ قُلْ أَعُوذُ بِرَبِّ الْفَلَقِ I seek refuge in the Lord of the daybreak.
Beautiful.
It's so beautiful. It's just mindfulness, right?
I'm beginning my day, the break of my day, with Allah's protection.
Right. From what? From the evil of that which He created.
Interesting.
This comes the challenge, right?
Yeah.
From the evil of darkness when it settles. And from the evil of the blowers in knots.
Witchcraft.
Exactly. And from the evil of the envier when he envies.
That encompasses everything, actually. All the dark energy that a mommy could receive from her environment and her surroundings.
That's like a protection.
Yeah, exactly. It just created this like bubble around her, this glass case that protects her from all that negative vibe. And pregnant women, I feel like, are so susceptible to that, the negative energy and to evil eye and all that nonsense. Because...
Nonsense?
No, nonsense as if those people who created
are nonsensical
people.
Right.
Because she has an innocent soul in her. And she's so pure now. And I don't know if you feel it or not, but pregnant women have this aura to them,
I know.
Want to protect them.
They're so motherly,
them.
You know?
Exactly.
They're so innocent. I totally agree with you. So this is one thing, one recommendation for the preconception. This is even the preconception that
right.
You're getting ready to have or to accept that amana in yourself. Next one is that after this is to be done by a man, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam says that when a man decides that he and his wife would like to have a child, after the Jum'ah prayer, this is so, you know, planning in Islam. It's like everything is like, oh, it just happened, accident. You don't have such accident thing. Imam Sadiq is like for 1,400 years back, after the namaz of Jum'ah, recite two rak'ah of prayers, make sujood, and with a mindful way, and say this beautiful dhikr. Allahumma, inni as'aluka bima sa'alaka bihi zakariya, rabba la tazarni fardan, wa anta khayrul warithin. So, O Lord, I ask you from what Zakaria asked you, mm-hmm. not to make me to be lonely, to, you know, not to have any offspring. You know, I want some good offspring from you. وأنت خير الوارثين. You are the best of inheritors. اللهم حبلي من لدنك ذرية طيبة. So you're so mindful. Preconception. Mm. This is fatherhood.
Let's move the pure offspring.
Yeah. إنك سامع الدعاء. You hear me. Right?
Right.
You hear my breath. Mm. You know my intention. I know that I'm talking to someone who has the power and who's listening, right? Allahumma, bismika istahlaltuha. This is the one that I was saying. That with your name you made me halal. You sang with the lady. Wa fi amanatika akhadtuha. And I took her as your trust. I took her. I made, you know, he's confessing. I took her as your trust. Fa in qazaita fi rahimiha waladan. فاجعله غلاما مباركا زكيا ولا تجعل للشيطان فيه شركا ولا نصيبا. So if you have decreed that in her body, in her womb, there will be a child, so please make that child mubarak, to be auspicious. Zaki,
clean, pure.
Clean. Yeah, and this is very important. ولا تجعل للشيطان فيه شركا. And to not
for have the devil not to have a share in him.
Yeah, and there's a big story about what this means. This refers to one of the verses of the Quran. This is in the Noble Quran chapter Isra, verse number 64, where it says, "وَاسْتَفْزِزْ مَنْ اسْتَطَعْتَ مِنْهُمْ بِصَوْتِكَ وَأَجْلِبْ عَلَيْهِمْ بِخَيْلِكَ وَرِجْلِكَ وَشَارِكْهُمْ فِي الْأَمْوَالِ وَالْأَوْلَادِ وَعِدْهُمْ وَمَا يَعِدُهُمُ الشَّيْطَانُ إِلَّا غُرُورًا." Which means that instigate whomever of them you can with your voice and rally against them your cavalry and your infantry and share with them in wealth and children. Well, this is so strong. And make promises to them. But Satan promises them nothing but delusion.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir.
Someone came to one of the infallibles, I think it was Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, and said, you know, what's the story behind this verse? And he said that this share with them in wealth and children refers to people whom earn their livelihood, their sustenance from other than the halal way. And then when they are conceiving their child, Shaitan or Satan will have a share in that child. Because, you know, the wealth they have accumulated, they have eaten it, the food, the nutrition, the effect on the spirituality, on the body, on the soul. And then, you know, it's like we are helping, we are actually duplicating the army of
the seeds.
This shaitan.
Scary.
Truly is.
There's no wonder that Allah subhanahu, like the ahadith say that earning sustenance, earning halal sustenance is a form of jihad and struggling in the path of Allah. It's so much more than being immoral, you know, like accepting bribes and usurping other people's rights. Aside from it being immoral, it creates your lineage. It creates individuals that are conceived, that the fibers and the tissues in their bodies and the neurons in their brains, their DNA structure is based on impure sustenance. And imagine when these people go out into society, they end up being, yeah, again, murderers of Palestinians and their imam. When Imam Hussein alayhi salam was addressing the enemy's army, and he was like, all right, they're not even listening to me. They can't hear me because their bellies are filled with haram food. So if a person who consumes haram food can, you know, kill their imam, they can easily kill Palestinian innocent children. And really shows why it's so important for Muslim men out there to be mindful of this, and for Muslim women to be mindful of choosing men who are careful about where they get their money from.
sometimes you choose a man who's careful, but then you make this man.
Exactly.
You know, you destroy the man.
Yeah, cheat, steal, and lie just so that...
he wants to impress you.
Exactly.
He wants to, like, get you your attention. Because you're never content with what he does, with what he brings.
You're never satisfied, and you want your children to have the designer clothes that your cousin does, and you want to have that new set of jewelry that your sister-in-law updated herself, and you want to change your furniture every year, and you want to change your kitchen set every year and stuff like that. And at the end of the day, we're just gonna die and leave it behind. They're not gonna even bury this stuff with us.
At the end of the day, get even like one step before that, you will have a messed up family.
Yeah,
no peace of mind, no love, no attention. Mm-hmm. You know, between the spouses, a really chaotic family. So it goes back to you. And today I was reading this beautiful verse that how much we can influence what happens even in nature, like the amount of rain. Like, you see, we are, through our actions, we are duplicating the army of Shaitan, and we are helping him. Sometimes we are the cause of drought, because there's a beautiful verse that says in chapter 30, verse number 41, زهر الفساد في البر والبحر
بما كسبت أيدي الناس
بما كسبت أيدي الناس. Corruption has appeared in land and sea because of the doings of the people. There's this TV show going on, and it's going viral on YouTube, Zendegi Pesa Zendegi, Life After Life, right? It's a Persian show, but a lot of people are watching it worldwide. In one of the episodes, this guy was saying that once I was driving, he's a cycler, he's like Olympic cycler, and he said that I was passing this car, there was this family beside me, and I smiled to the child, and I just continued by. He went into a trauma, got unconscious, and his soul was separated from his body,
right.
And he could see scenes. And he said, that smile of mine to that girl, the little child in the car, then it had so many effect on the family. So even the small, this tiniest particle of what you do has impact on your surroundings.
I mean, on one hand, we feel like, oh, wow, look, a simple smile affects my life and their life so much. And then on the other hand, you're like, oh, no.
I have to be super mindful and conscious all
so
the time.
Exactly, so careful. You are constantly on the edge of your seat, being careful of what everything you do, you say, you think.
Preconception, spiritual points that you have to take into mind. One was having wudu all the time. Two, familiarity with the Quran. And a prayer, you know, asking Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala constantly to give you a spouse and a child that is, you know, mubarak and zakiyan. Another key concept for spiritual purification is repentance, which inshallah we will be talking about in our next program.
Thank you so much, Sister Razi, and thank you to our listeners for being with us. Until then, and another episode of Muslim Lady, I leave you in the care and protection of the Almighty. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
I know I'm waiting, waiting for something, something to happen to me. This waiting comes with trials and challenges. Nothing in life is free. I wish that somehow you tell me out aloud that on that day I'll be okay.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.